There is a balm in Gilead to make the wounded whole. We all know that song and love that song, don't we? A song that's written from the context of Jeremiah 8. But the question in Jeremiah 8 is there a balm in Gilead? Because the people here weren't sure at all whether there was going to be healing. They knew they were terminally sick, but they weren't sure if help was going to come. We've reached this place now in Jeremiah. We've been in it for a while now, and we've reached this place where Jeremiah's repeated warnings to God's people are falling on deaf ears, and it's almost certain that the destiny of God's people is going in this one direction. The people are hurtling towards exile. All these predictions of invasions, it's going to come true. There's a certainty now in Jeremiah. And at the center of this passage, God, like a parent, is asking his people, why did you do this? Why did you provoke me to this anger? Why did you provoke me to anger? It's the anguish of a parent who's just so frustrated with their children. A couple of weeks ago, our little team, our Dwelling in the Word team, were looking at this text, trying to discern how this passage might be relevant to us today. And one of the people in the group, when we looked at the raw emotion that was spilling out from this passage, one of our group said, you know, the only time I felt that kind of provocation to anger was when I had little children. And those of us who were parents in the room knew exactly what they were talking about. Because these little people know how to push your buttons until you're seeing the edge, you're going over the edge, and you've fallen way down over the edge. And for that moment in the Dwelling of the Word time, we went off passage and we began to talk about parenting and how hard it was. And we shared our stories of how we nearly fell off the edge as parents. This past week, I was remembering a time when our two older boys were little people, and we were having a holiday on the north coast. It was February, so still winter, very cold. We were walking along the beach in our coats, and one of our boys had this precious toy, little plastic toy, Wall-E from the Pixar movie, little tiny thing. Beloved. And as they played closer and closer to the sea, you know what happened? The Wall-E fell down and began to be sucked out into the Atlantic Ocean. And these Atlantic Ocean waves, they're very strong, so they are. And so this piece of oblong plastic that's yellow, I could see it begin to drift out further and further away into the ocean. This was a beloved toy. And so one of our little people began to wade out further and further to try and get this little yellow blob of plastic. And we yelled, don't do it, don't do it. Because they didn't know how to swim at this stage, and we knew this was not the right thing to do. But they kept drifting out further and further. And I can still feel the fear in my bones of seeing a little person getting waist up, and then it was beginning to get towards the shoulders, drifting further and further out to get this toy. And the toy was way, way out by this stage. And so I decided it's time to go in. So fully clothed, waded in, picked up the child, brought it back, but then had to start swimming to go get this piece of Wall-E plastic. And I tell you, that was a low. That was a low in our family. I was pushed over the parental edge that day. What am I doing? I'm swimming in icy cold water for this piece of plastic. But I knew I had to get it for the sanity of our family life. But it can be frightening, those emotions you go through as a parent, can't it? You feel anger. Why is this happening? You feel hurt. You feel broken. Your pride as a parent. How did we reach this place? And what do you do with all those emotions? And especially the anger, you know, you want to turn your face away. You don't want to deal with it because you just feel so frustrated in those moments. And I'm sure you, as parents, all have your stories to tell. Maybe it was today. Maybe it was this summer on vacation. I don't know. Or maybe they're long ago. But we all have those stories of frustration, of being pushed just so far over the edge. When Jeremiah is talking here, he is lamenting like a parent. He's talking like a parent that's been pushed over the edge. Some translations actually use parental language. Listen to the cry of my poor daughter. Has Yahweh left us? There's anguish there. There's a sorrow and a disappointment. And this is all causing disorientation. The people themselves are beginning to doubt, was God ever our parent? Was God ever really with us? The people are feeling so much pain that they can't get straight in their heads whether God is here or over there. And even Jeremiah mirrors this feeling. On the one hand, yes, he feels the hurt of his people. He identifies with it. But only a few verses later, he just feels so angry with the people. He says these words, "Oh, that I had a lodging place for travelers in a faraway desert that I might leave my people. Oh, that I might have a nice cottage on Lake Michigan where I can retreat to." He just wants to get away from it all. When C.S. Lewis's wife died, he wrote that book, A Grief Observed, and he talks about how sorrow can unearth this kind of disorientation. He writes these words, "Meanwhile, where is God? This is one of the most disquieting symptoms. When you are happy, so happy that you have no sense of needing him, you're tempted to feel his claims upon you as an interruption. If you remember yourself and turn to him with gratitude and praise, you will be welcomed with open arms. But to go to him when your need is desperate, when all other help is in vain, when you need him, what do you find but the sound of the door slammed in your face, the sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside, and after that, silence. You may as well turn away. There are no lights in the windows. It might be an empty house. Was it ever inhabited? It seems so once. What can this mean? Why is he so present a commander in our prosperity and so very absent to help in our time of trouble?" It's powerful, isn't it? I know I've felt that at times, that ambiguity, the doubts, the questions, is God really with us or not? So how did the people get to this place? I want to spend a minute tracing this trajectory of how did the people get here. Well, earlier on, Jeremiah talks about instinctive natural rhythms of life. When you're walking along, Jeremiah says in chapter 8, and you fall down, of course you're going to try and get up. If you leave your house, of course there'll be a moment when you come back to it. Then he goes on to talk about migration and birds. I remember as a child this time of year, as I was going out for school, I'd look up at the telegraph pole and see the swallows lining up, all clustering together to get ready for migration. And Jeremiah told his people, even these birds know instinctively what to do, when they should be on the move to migrate, when to go away, when to come back home again. But Jeremiah says the problem with this people is they just don't have that instinctiveness any longer. They go away, and instead of coming back, they go away a little bit further and away a bit further again. And the tragedy is this travel away is masked by the leadership, by the leaders who were really slick and saying, well, it's not that bad. It's not that bad. Their view of reality was distorted because it had been this slow, gradual drift. Do you ever see that happen in a classroom? Maybe some of you are teachers and you try to build this relationship with your students, but gradually the teasing rises until no one begins to recognize that line between teacher and student. The line of respectability has been crossed, and behavior is no longer recognized or evaluated as embarrassing, and the group becomes immune, and that's when you need to pull it in again. That inability to see prejudice for what it really is, that inability to see slander being used. What starts out as gentle teasing now has become emotional bullying. It's what happens when we get so hardened, we lose that ability to feel shame. That child who's not valued and loved at home and no longer cares what people think of them, they've put on this tough exterior so that they don't feel woundedness and don't feel the shame. Abram Heschel says, it's this loss of embarrassment that's the decisive step towards our loss of humanness. And so the people had gone away, they drifted, but they'd become hardened. And the final quality of their failure was lack of fruitfulness. That phrase, the harvest is past, the summer is over, and we've nothing to show. There's that anguish coming through in this phrase. Think of all the harvests we have in Michigan, the beautiful peaches and blueberries, and now we're into apple orchards. It's beautiful. And the same would have been true in the land of Judah, different harvests at different times, starting with the wheat, then moving on to the fruit and the figs and the grapes, which meant if the wheat harvest wasn't so good, well, you could rely on your figs or maybe your grapes and salvage something. But harvest after harvest had failed, and now the summer was over. There was no harvest. Moment after moment had passed, and there was nothing to show, and the people were realizing we're facing winter, and we have nothing in storage. It's empty. We've no reserve to get us through. And you would think this is surely the point where God's children simply come back to God in their emptiness and say, fill us again. Like hungry children that run up to their parents and say, Mom, I'm hungry. What's in the cupboard? But rather than come empty to be filled, they come to God with blame and say, how dare you, God? How dare you do this to us? You are the one who said you'd always be in Zion. And now, look, Zion is going to be attacked. Surely if you're the captain of this ship, you should be here defending it. Why isn't the king in his rightful place? And even that harvest phrase, the harvest is past, the summer is ended, we're not saved. That was a liturgy they used to appeal to God. God, you knew this was the time when the harvest was up. Why are you a little behind your liturgical calendar? We feel it's our duty to remind you, you need to show up for business as usual. Do you see how twisted it has become? It should have been the people self-evaluating themselves why their harvests had failed. But instead, they pushed that evaluation to God. Do you ever do that? Do you ever say to God, God, what are you up to? Because you see, it's in the center of this despair you begin to see your own idols. When your world is beginning to fall down around you, when life is changing in an unwelcome way, the temptation is to try and fix things, to hold on to things that are not going to change. God, you should be on your holy hill. God, you should turn up whenever the correct liturgy is being used, because after all, we're on the right side of morality. We're good people. We deserve to be free from pain. We deserve a better life than this. We've worked hard for this. And all of a sudden, faith becomes a performance, doesn't it? How we are performing. We have worked hard. We deserve better. Our performance as parents, our performance as individuals, our performance as a nation, rather than God and what he's done for us. And the sin word for this is moralism. The attempt to try and organize your life around controllable objects without being inwardly transformed. It's moralism. I wonder if you've heard the story of Rosie Ruiz, the lady who won the Boston Marathon in 1980. Rosie Ruiz was the first woman to cross the finish line of the Boston Marathon, and it was her first marathon. No one had ever heard of her. She was this wild card winner. And it seemed almost too good to be true. Where had Rosie come from? But as people began to probe Rosie a bit further, they realized, you know, she doesn't look like a marathon runner. Her physique is not like a long-distance runner. And also, when they began to ask other people who had run the race, no one had actually seen Rosie on the course. And gradually, the truth emerged. Rosie had hopped onto the race in the last mile and crossed the finish line. That's how to win a marathon, folks. So the question became, why, Rosie, did you do this? And different people began to interview her, and no one could really get to the bottom of what was going on in Rosie's mind. But one interviewer wrote, I think Rosie actually believed she won the marathon that day. She actually believed she had completed the race, and she was analyzed as a sociopath. No sense of right and wrong, no sense of morality. Eugene Peterson writes this about Rosie. In reading about Rosie, I thought of all the people I know who want to get in on the finish, who cleverly arrange not to run the race. They appear in church on Sunday in wreathed smiles, entering into the celebration, but there's no personal life that leads up to it or out from it. Occasionally, they engage in spectacular acts of love and compassion. They're plausible, they're convincing, but in the end, they do not run the race. Believing through the tough times, praying through the lonely, angry, hurt hours, they have no sense of what is real in religion. And the proper label for such a person as this is not sociopath, but religiopath. And I think what Peterson is getting at here is in Jeremiah's day, there were many religiopaths, people who were terminally sick. There was no balm in Gilead that was going to cure them, no doctor in the house that was going to look after them, because there was nothing to be done. And sometimes God lets us get to that place of utter despair to see the idols we've patched onto our living. We need to be brought up short sometimes with our failure to recognize what it means to be authentic, to recognize all the shortcuts we take in our spirituality to try and run the race and finish it well and look good. Religiopaths, it's what we all are. So as we read through Jeremiah 8, where is the hope, you may be asking? Is that it? Is that all we're going to get? This Zion community trundling towards their death, all the avenues for repentance have been turned away and spurned, and we're left with this gaping chasm between the failure of Israel and the expectation of what God should have done. Where is the verse that whispers hope? Well, the reality is there isn't any. All we get today is the grief. Because the truth is, this sickness is beyond healing. We can't do a thing about it. It's going to end in a death for this people. But you know, sometimes that grief is worth paying attention to, because in it becomes good news. The good news is that we have to look for a hope that is beyond ourselves, from a source outside of ourselves. We can't fix this. We can't perform our way out of our lives like a good parent with good living and good education. None of these things will save us. Only God can, and God must act in this unqualified freedom to do something for us that we can't do for ourselves. That's the good news. It's not about us. Our hope is in Jesus Christ. He is our hope. But there's something more I want you to see here. Because as you read this Jeremiah 8 and 9, this beautiful poetry, we get a glimpse into the pathos, the grief of God. God is, even though he's perfectly free, in his independence, he's allowing himself to be affected by his people outside of himself. He didn't need to do that. And we're getting a telling glimpse into the inner workings of God, that God feels these things for us. God feels crushed when we are crushed. When we feel intense sorrow, God feels it more. And God understands pain because he is standing under us. And for those of us today who are so scared to let anyone know how they're really feeling, because the darkness is heavy on you and the depression is deep in your bones, I want to say to you, God stands with and for and among and under and in you. In the ones who are hurting so badly, God is in you, feeling that with you. Our passage ends with Jeremiah saying, "My head is not big enough to cry the tears I need to cry." Have you ever felt that way, where your head is not big enough to hold the grief? But it's in this place we realize these are not just Jeremiah's tears, they're God's tears. God weeps for us. Because Jeremiah's words and God's words have become so intertwined at this stage, we don't know one from the other. And this is the deep paradox of the God we love and serve. All along, when people have been pushing God away or accusing God of abandoning them, he has been there. He's been present. He's been feeling every moment of pain. And God stayed. And God became united with that hurt and forsakenness. The people had messed up so badly, they couldn't lay claim to the new world. But the good news is this: the new world was going to be this gift from God that no one could earn. We can't do anything to get it, and that's good news. But it takes utter hopelessness to realize that. This is not the denial to hope. This is the door to hope. And we see God in his love, yes, in his anger, but in his love, and it's a suffering love. This balm in Gilead, this old African-American spiritual, to heal the sin-sick soul. There is a balm in Gilead to make the wounded whole. I think it's so interesting that it took a slave to dare to respond with hope to the hopelessness of Jeremiah 8. Perhaps we need to get to that place where we realize there's nothing we can do to get out of the mess we're sometimes in. We need to die to our dreams. We need to become captives in order to experience that freedom. We need death in order to have life, so that God's living hope can resurrect us. But in the meantime, God is there. God is present. God stays with us in our hurting. So as we close together, what I'm going to invite us to do, Henry and Jeff are going to come up and read Jeremiah 8 for us again. But rather than have Jeff read God's question, he's going to read all of it to remind us God is feeling all these emotions, not just the anger, but the sorrow, the hurt. And use this reading as an invitation to ask yourself the question, where do I despair? Because in the center of your despair is the idol that you need to let go of. The idol that we think we're going to protect ourselves from this world. The idol of trying to be good parents. The idol of good education. The idol of thinking we deserve better. Hand over these idols to God and fall into the sorrow of a God who cares enough for us that one day he will come and give us that balm to make us whole again.